All right, today is January 29th, 2016. This is an interview with David Stanley. This is a phone interview. David is in Montana, right?
In Livingston, near Livingston, Montana.
Okay, and then I am Troy Reeves, and I am here in my office at the UW-Madison Archives. David, if you wouldn't mind, I know you just said something, but if you wouldn't mind saying your name and spelling your last name to help me with the sound quality.
David Stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y.
Excellent. And we can hear you, and the recorder can hear you just fine.
Okay, terrific.
All right, so, and we're going to talk today about David's time at UW, specifically within a program called the Ford Scholars. So, David, my first question I usually ask to most alumni is, why UW?
Well, I chose UW for reasons that are not as sensible now as they seemed at the time. The Ford Scholarship was offered at Yale, Columbia, Chicago, and Wisconsin. As to Yale, 60-plus years ago, it was not co-ed. Columbia would have called for me to commute from home, which I did not want to do. I was brought up about 40, 35 miles from Columbia. My brother, about whom more later if you like, was at Chicago, and I didn't want to go there. He was ultimately diagnosed as schizophrenic and lived his life that way. And Wisconsin was left. Now, I have normally believed that while I was not one of the top 200 people that applied for this scholarship, I probably had to be one of the top 50 who chose Wisconsin first. But I chose Wisconsin first, and frankly, I think I only chose Yale as second and didn't go any further. But that's a long time ago.
David, since we don't know who will listen to this and in what context, could you talk a little bit more about your memories of the Ford Scholar Program, maybe starting by what you remember when you first heard about it?
I heard about it from my brother, who was at Chicago, and some kind of brochure was circulated at the University of Chicago, and he sent this to home, and my parents got it, and we talked about whether I should do this. I was 15 at the time. I believe it was in the spring of 1951. And I kind of said, well, what the hell? Why not take the exam? And so did they. I don't know now, and may not have known then, what the exam was, but I remember taking it in Peekskill, and there were a bunch of other people there who were not taking it for the Ford Scholarship Program, Peekskill, New York, that is. And my guess is it was an SAT or an ACT or whatever was the predecessor of those in 1951. But I took it because it was there. I learned about it because it was publicized at the University of Chicago. No one in my school had my high school had any understanding of what the Ford Scholarship was.
Okay. And maybe just to get a bit more context pre-UW, you said Columbia was close, so where did you grow up?
I grew up at the north edge of Westchester County, New York, kind of non-fashionable Westchester. Westchester's got the wonderful stuff of Scarsdale and Chappaqua and New Rochelle, whatever. I grew up in Yorktown Heights, New York, which was kind of rural, not thoroughly rural, but for example, we lived in a house that had 4 acres, but it was also bought for $7,500 in the late 30s. So it was not particularly, there were plenty of estates up there, but we weren't one of them. My high school had 28 people in my class, and my recollection is that only 6 went on to higher education. And two of those were for teaching, 2 were for nursing, and 2 were for engineering, and then me.
So, I mean, it sounds like it, maybe not amazing is the right word, but you came from a high school that didn't have a track record of people going to college, so...
No, it did not, and I wasn't a particularly great high school student. people in the high school were the descendants of people who came from southern Italy to work on the aqueducts and the dam in the New York water system, New York City water system. And it was very Catholic. Almost everybody in high school was Catholic. And there was no tradition of college, particularly, or higher education.
But was there, well, your brother's at University of Chicago, so there must have been at least some tradition within your own family about higher education.
Oh, both of my parents were college graduates. They were both born in 1903. They were both college graduates, and both of my mother's parents were college graduates, all of those people from the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. And my father was an educated and sophisticated person, a journalist much of the time, and my mother was a Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Nebraska. I once gave a speech which began, "My mother, a Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Nebraska, who wore her key around the house," not an easy woman to be with much of the time. But I mean, they were sophisticated and cultured people.
Okay. So, David, is there anything else on your mind about this pre-UW time that you'd like to discuss before we get you here to Madison, so to speak?
I think that I didn't understand at the time, but I understand now that as I go through life, I'm about a 280 hitter, in a baseball metaphor, but I hit occasional Grand Slam home runs, and I'm sure that the test for the Ford Scholarship was one of those home runs. Later in life, I took the LSAT to go to law school, was in the 99th percentile. I had no academic record that would indicate that. And then later, I was an editor of the Columbia Law Review because I was so afraid my first year in law school that I came out eighth in a class of 300. And I had no academic, no reason, no history, nothing told me that should have happened. It was just idiosyncratic home runs. Okay, that's how I think of myself. And I didn't expect the scholarship, and when I got to Wisconsin, more later.
Okay. So then, had you been to the Midwest or even, Madison or Wisconsin before you came here to matriculate?
No. I had gone to Nebraska to see grandparents at the end of the Second World War, and that's the only long travel I'd had west. Everything else, I mean, they're have in mind that from age 5 to age 10, we had the war and there was essentially no travel. And then there was no great tradition of travel among people of middle-class income. And I hadn't traveled.
So then, how did you get from New York State to Madison?
I think the first time I took a train to Chicago, changed trains, and took a train to Madison. Came alone. My parents did not come with me. And I don't believe, actually, that my parents ever visited me at Wisconsin. But I think I took the train. And subsequently, I might have flown once or twice back and forth. But in my second and third years, I had a car at Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I drove to and from New York on those couple of times a year that you'd go back. And this was before the freeway system was put together, the interstates.
Mm-hmm. So train through Chicago, did you spend time with your brother?
No. My brother had been in a school for troubled children in high school, and he was very difficult and was diagnosed as schizophrenic in the late 50s, maybe 1958. But I stayed away from him, and for much of our lives we didn't see each other, although my wife and I supported him for the last 10 years or 12 years of his life.
Okay. Not to, you know, ask you questions you may not have the answer to, but it seems that if he was at University of Chicago, there must have been some parts of his psyche or life that were in order.
Well, I suppose that some parts of his life were in order. You may have in mind that in, say, 1949 or whenever he went, and I think he probably went in 1949 or 50, University of Chicago was run by Robert M. Hutchins, and it was a school based upon comprehensive exams. You were not required to attend class, and you just took your comprehensive and could graduate based on that. He never did graduate, but it was very clearly an alternative school suitable for people who were not quite in the mainstream.
Mm, okay. All right. Well, let's get you here to Madison then. What do you recall, if anything, you know, about your initial thoughts about either the town or the campus or both?
Well, what I remember, first of all, that it had maybe 40,000 students in 1951, that many of them were GI Bill, were Second World War people, and maybe a few that were in and out of Korea. That might have been too early for that. But I remember that I was very, very young and from a small town. I'd been to New York many times because we lived 30, 40 miles away, but not any place. I've been to Washington, I suppose, but not any place else. And it was quite striking, quite stunning. Professor Howe, Dr. Howe, Evelyn put his arms around us, so that Howe in a small way was in loco parentis, but I was very young and very unsophisticated, and didn't get it. Kind of, where am I? What am I doing?
Right.
I'd never been a particularly good studier. I wasn't in the top of my high school class, even in Yorktown Heights, and unprepared for what was going on in Wisconsin. I did take tests well, and as a result, I did okay as a student, although I was probably a B student. And one of the really striking things was the difference between me and my life experiences and many of the other Ford scholars. Many of them were from places like the High School of Music and Art in New York, from New Trier in Chicago, from Bronx Science, just really very different high school experiences. Could easily have taken calculus in their sophomore year, and no calculus was offered in my high school at all, ever. I felt unequal to them, generally speaking.
David, did that make it difficult to bond with them?
Difficult to bond with some. I had not had much experience in my peer relationships, much experience with Jewish people. And a large percentage of the Ford scholars, as I recollect it, were Jews from academic and highly educated families, doctors. There were several who were the children of rabbis. There were several who were the children of academics. They had educational experiences and probably cultural experiences that I simply had not had. The high point of my early life would be to go to a Broadway show once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Number of these people, not all of them were from New York, but many were from New York and Boston and from big cities. They had very different experiences. I didn't feel that I was particularly a part of the group But I suppose for much of my life, until I was about 38, I felt like I wasn't a part of the group. You know, if people found out about me, they'd get me, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So I assume since you came from outside of Wisconsin that you, like some of the other Ford Scholars, had to stay off campus your first year?
Yes, I lived at 618 West Dayton. I cannot remember the name of the woman who ran the place. She had a family, and they lived on the first floor, and then there were two more floors of rooms, and I had a roommate. And my roommate was a Ford Scholar from New York. Father was a distinguished physician, and they lived on Central Park West in a, you know, glamorous place, the Beresford, as I remember it. And I would visit him when I came back, and it was a, you know, a way of life I didn't understand.
So let's talk a little bit about your initial experiences as a student then. I know you've talked a little bit about your study habits and your test taking, but logistically, I wonder if you could talk about getting here and then just first off registering for classes. What are your memories of that?
Well, I remember the registration process, and particularly I remember that all of us, I think at least boys, had to go to the armory for a physical that had to do with ROTC. And at that physical, I was given what I now remember as a Schick test. Do you know what that is?
I do not.
Well, it was a test for tuberculosis where they went under the skin and injected something that would give you an eruption if you had tuberculosis. You'd get a reaction. And I think it was a medical student who was doing this, and he went under the skin, but opened it up and opened it up and opened it up. So I had a line about, let's say, 8 inches long that was welling, slightly welling blood, okay? And the physician who was in charge of all of this in the line took me out of the line and did whatever she had to do to stop the bleeding, okay? And I was then asked if there was any reason that I couldn't serve in the military, that I should be exempt from ROTC, which was mandatory at the time. And remember, this is in the time of universal military training. Okay? So that if you got to the end of your second year and you weren't in ROTC, you would be drafted. Actually, at the end of my second year, I'd have been 17, and I don't know if I'd been drafted or not, but that was the theory. So you had to go into ROTC. And I said to this female doctor, I said, I've got a really bad knee from basketball. And she thereupon exempted me from ROTC, which was quite a change in life, because many of our folks did go in the service, after graduation, and I never had to serve. So that was quite an experience. Then the whole question of what to do in college, what courses to take, and the like. I had no college preparation to speak of, and so I did take ILS. And you asked if I took ILS, and I did take ILS, and in great measure because it was a comprehensive answer to what do you do. Hmm. And Dr. Howe recommended it. And, I did take ILS, and there was some bonding or certainly some familiarity among the couple of hundred people who did take ILS, and they became a part of my group of friends.
Okay.
A number of Ford Scholars had been to places like Bronx Science, and a couple of them went into mathematics immediately, a couple went into physics. They were very different preparations, and I've seen them in recent years, and they've lived different lives.
Okay. You mentioned Howe a couple of times. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about your relationship with him, or perhaps also the relationship he had in general with the Ford Scholars in the program.
There were people who had very close relationships with Dr. Howe and Evelyn Howe. I was not one of them. But he clearly was the go-to guy. It's the only faculty member that at least I felt any opportunity to talk to for certainly the first year. I became relatively close to Dr. David Feldman in my second and third years, but Howe was the only guy for the early part of the time I was there, and he was paternal, warm, and was helpful. I have seen him a couple of times in the last 60 years. I came down when we, a group of us, funded a lectureship, I believe, and saw him then, and he was pretty frail, and I saw him sometime. My son went to the University of Wisconsin, and I was down there a number of times in the late 50s, early 60s. The late 70s, early 80s. Whoa. And Dr. Howe was, I believe, retired, but I saw him once then.
Okay. So your son came here in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, let's see. My son was born in 62. And I didn't bring him to 70, to 80. So, yes, he was there from 1980 to 1984, I suppose.
Okay.
Graduate school after that, yeah.
Okay. So that was an occasion that would bring you back to campus was to...
Yes, and actually during the 80s and 90s, I would be in Madison visiting the State Investment Board, which was an investor in the company I was involved with, six or eight times, and was on campus a number of times.
Okay.
In terms of the other Ford scholars, the people in my house and other Ford people in ILS were my social circle for the first year or two. I lived in that house on West Dayton with Ford scholars and a couple of other people for the first year. And my recollection of the first year is I never went home.
Hmm.
The scholarship was $1,500, as I recollected it. That's what I got. And I maybe got another $1,000 from my parents. And while the economy was very, very different at the time, $2,500 was not enough to go back and forth to New York very often.
So do you recall where you lived then? You were here for 3 years, so the next couple years?
Yes, I lived for a year at 618 West Dayton, and then a non-Ford scholar and I took an apartment in a farmhouse on the south side of Lake Monona. And if you could tell me what the suburbs are that are out there, I could tell you what town it was in, but it was 15 miles from the university.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I lived for, I think, for a year in a basement apartment in a farmhouse out on south of Monona.
Okay.
Then I lived for a year, this time with Ford Scholars again, at 22 North Butler. That's a Frank Lloyd Wright house that's in the middle of the block between, I think, Wisconsin and something, whatever the next street toward Lake Mendota is. But it's in the it's in the geographic middle of the block. It's not on the street.
Mm.
It was a different kind of place.
Okay.
And it was kind of a magnet for Ford scholars as well in the third year.
So that second year, I guess it was nice to have a car.
Somehow or other, you know, I went there about 6 weeks after I got my driver's license. I went to Wisconsin. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's, and that's an indication of how young and isolated I might have been. I mean, I had a girlfriend in high school, but you know, you could never go anywhere because I lived outside town and she lived outside town, and you know, you really couldn't date with your father driving you and necking in the back seat. It just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, having a girlfriend was not like it would be if you were mobile. In addition to which, she was a part of one of those Italian families, and you couldn't be alone with her unless her grandmother gave you permission. You know, this being 60 years ago, I saw her at the at my 50th high school reunion, and she was just as gorgeous as she was in high school. But anyway.
So then, you would commute from that farmhouse back and forth.
Yes, I would, and I probably would even stay in town to have dinner. I normally had a meal ticket at a diner on University Avenue, about in the 600 or 700 block, very near to. It's probably been incorporated into the campus now. I'm pretty sure 600 West Dayton was. I think all of that's incorporated into the campus.
Mm-hmm.
A thing for you, for me to tell you, and we can come back to that. I worked my second and third years at Wisconsin. I was a bellhop at the Edgewater Hotel, and I also owned the pressing concession, pressing people's clothes in the days when people pressed clothes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very different approach to Wisconsin. I probably made 100 a week or more. And had a car, and you know, lived very differently than I did the first year. In the first year, I studied to the best of my ability, but I crammed. And thereafter, I probably didn't study and crammed all the time.
So, can you say a bit more about the pressing concession?
Pressing clothes. People would come into the hotel,
okay,
and they're dresses or their pants would be wrinkled or their coats would be wrinkled, and you would press them and take them back to the room for a fee and a tip.
Mm-hmm. All right, I just wanted to...
Bellhop, you checked people in, checked people out, brought them room service, and the Edgewater was pretty fancy then and might be pretty fancy now.
Yeah, I haven't been in it, but I've heard things, yes. Yeah, I just wanted to confirm that that was inside the Edgewater as well.
No, I was pressing. I had a. There was a little room for where you know, laundry would be brought and clothing to be pressed. The laundry would be sent out to a laundry somewhere, and the clothing to be pressed. I would press, or somebody who worked for me would press. Mm-hmm. It was an entrepreneurial thing that I mean, it wasn't very pleasant work, but you would press clothes and get them back, and you know, it was money.
Right. I know you said it before. How much were these jobs, the bellhop and the pressing concession job, bringing
well,
in?
As a bellhop, I mean, I had the pressing concession. I was a bellhop already, and I had the pressing concession maybe after about 4 or 5 months. Wasn't something people wanted, because you have to be willing to be present with, you know, some alacrity then and there. Somebody wanted their clothes pressed and wanted them back. And there was no cell phone, of course, so you couldn't, you had to either be there or not. I would say that, you might make $20 a shift as a bellhop. And I might make $15 a day, although it's other people. people were pressing for me, and they made most of the money then. But I might make $15 a day for pressing. So it didn't work every day. And it, you know, the jobs were designed for college students. I might have made 100 a week for maybe a little more, which in 1952-53 was, you know, not bad. I mean, when I graduated law school in 57, I was paid $2.25 an hour, made $5,500 a year, so whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty good. It's a pretty lush job for being in college. An interesting fact, and you may not have heard of this guy, but the night desk clerk at the Edgewater when I was there was a man named John Murdoch, who was, when he died a few years ago, was an emeritus professor of history of science at Harvard, and one of the giants of history of science and philosophy of the late 20th century. Murdoch would be well known to the philosophers and the history of science people at Wisconsin.
Right.
He was the night desk clerk, you know.
So David, you talked about, you know, the second and third year because of the jobs you had, that you were cramming, sort of more than studying and cramming. But specifically,
I've never been a studying person. You know, mm-hmm. Work and the like. I mean, or just reading the book when you're supposed to read it. Never.
Okay.
So that goes back to hitting home runs rather than having a high batting average.
Mm-hmm. So I want to use this discussion to talk specifically about the classes you do remember, though. So are there classes that stood out for whatever reason during your time here?
There were a couple of classic classes taught by Agard and I believe a guy named Mackenzie. And they were, you know, Plato, Aristotle, what have you. And they were, you know, absolutely brand new to me. I didn't know any of it, and they were both quite remarkable teachers and quite remarkable scholars. I assume there are chairs and things named for Agard at Wisconsin now. I remember classes in political science with David Fellman, who he'd be 100 plus now, I'm sure. 120, I suppose. I don't know. And he was kind of a brilliant scholar, a brilliant teacher, and he was a minor mentor. To the extent that I had a mentor at Wisconsin, it would have been Fellman, and he was among the people that I consulted about finishing there or going to law school.
Mm. Okay.
Let me tell you something about ILS.
Sure.
In ILS, I met my first wife, and she was in kind of sitting in front of me. You almost always went into the same place in the auditorium for ILS. And I met my first wife, and she was, she was a big deal. She was the vice president of the Student Senate and the first woman to have that position. And is that student government at Wisconsin now?
Yeah.
Okay, well, she was number two in the Student Senate. And she, in the end of the second and in the third year, became a kind of a center focal point of my social life. Mm-hmm. That was ILS as well. But a lot of people knew her. She knew a lot of people. She was much more connected than I to the university overall.
I assume she was a bit older than you?
She was born in 33, I was born in 35, yes.
Okay, so not much of a difference, though.
You know, 20 some months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, that put me in touch with, she was from Baraboo, you know,
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, she knew a lot of people in the kind of the core of the university. And to some extent, certainly for the first year, the Ford students were more isolated or hanging together.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying here is meeting her allowed you to sort of broaden your possible social circle?
Yes, I think so. I think so.
So who among the Ford scholars, though, to get back to that, do you feel like you really struck up a friendship or close to a friendship with while you were there?
Well, Charlie Holbrow, and you may know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie has been my friend for all of this time, and we get together. I mean, I'm more affluent than Charlie, and I go to Boston now to see them, and I've been to Hamilton to see them. We live on a ranch out here, and they've been out here, and I've met them in Minnesota on occasions over the 50 years. I saw Charlie and Mary just before Thanksgiving last year. My wife and I went into
Mm-hmm.
Hillel Gershenson, do you know who that is?
I know that name.
He was one of those people that was so impressive that, you know, I kind of shrank. He had an eidetic memory. I remember an experience. There was something called the College Quiz Bowl many years ago, and I think it may have been on television. Probably not. It was probably on radio. Not much television in the early 50s. But Wisconsin had a team, and almost all, I think three of the four team members were Ford scholars. And there was a meeting in our apartment on North Butler Street where they were trying to, they were dealing with questions they expected. And one of the questions that they were trying to get the answer to was the name of Alexander the Great's horse, which you may know. Do you know the name
No.
of Alexander the Great's horse?
No.
Well, neither did anybody else, except that Hillel, who was not in the College Quiz Bowl, was off somewhere in a corner of the apartment, and he said, "What? What? Alexander the Great's horse? Bucephalus!" And I thought, you know, Jesus, you know, this guy knows everything he ever learned.
Mm-hmm.
Hillel was, after all these years, a memory of mine, and he actually went to the University of Minnesota for the faculty and was not very successful. I believe he was tenured, but tenured as an associate professor and called upon to retire early. I thought, my God, you know, here is a person who knows everything he ever learned, and I certainly didn't. So I remember Hillel, and I saw him some in Minnesota. I moved to Minnesota 1960, law school and practicing in New York briefly, and saw Hillel from time to time. Some of the others, I mean, I didn't see many of the others. Almost all of them went to a coast, and I was in the middle of the country, have been, you know, for 50 plus years, and I guess, either in the middle of the country or now in the West. And I remember names, and I've seen them at get-togethers, but none were friends of mine.
Okay. So,
mine in my adult life.
Right. How about non-Ford scholars that you met and got to know at UW? Did any of them stay, did you stay close with any of them throughout your life?
For a while. One of them was a guy named Dale Lang, might be famous. He started what's known as the spotlight that used to go in phone booths.
Mm-hmm.
And that little advertising, and went on into that field, and he invented Magazine Networks Inc., the preprints that are by zip code, where you can have Madison can advertise in Time Magazine. A Madison restaurant can advertise in Time Magazine, and they're only in the magazines that are distributed in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from having the post office 60 or so years ago decide that things were going to have zip codes and magazines and newspapers would be sorted by zip code, and mm-hmm. realized that the publisher had to sort by zip code, and if he came toward the end of the magazine print, he could have something that was put in a magazine that was zip code specific.
Okay.
And he invented that, and he sold it to 3M for about $50 million. And I knew him when I was in Minneapolis. Well, I knew him for years. He was in New York, but when he sold it to 3M, I was involved in that sale and represented him to some extent. And I represented him when I practiced law in Minnesota. There were some other people from Wisconsin who came to Minneapolis, and I stayed it connected to them. Terry Hutchinson, and some other people.
Okay.
But mostly, I have not maintained friendships either from college or from law school.
Okay. Maybe a couple more things this time.
And I think a part of that, frankly, is that I was very young in both college and law school. I graduated from law school at 21, and there was no one other than one woman. There was no one anywhere near my age in my class at law school.
Okay. Maybe just a couple more things for this time. We've talked a little bit about places on campus, places that you've lived, but what about, in the place you worked, Edgewater, but what about some favorite places or spaces for socializing either on or off campus?
Well, the union, of course, and I remember specifically a session at the union where Senator McCarthy spoke. You asked about McCarthy and some of that, and that was quite a thrilling thing to see McCarthy at that point. There was someone in the back of the room. He gave a speech in that room in the union that is wide and shallow. A stage in the front, probably on the third floor of the union.
Yep.
And he spoke from the stage, and someone in the back of the room, when he was taking questions, said in a stage lisp, "Senator, how did you find all those homosexuals in the State Department?" And McCarthy got angry and left the stage. A little homophobia there.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a couple of things that I should have said earlier.
Okay.
When I got to Wisconsin, I went out for wrestling. Okay. I was 130 something pounds, and probably 5'7", maybe 5'8". And the people who went out for wrestling were, in my memory, from Cicero and Berwyn, and they were Serbs and Czechs and what have you, little bitty guys with no neck, who had been wrestling since they were 10.
Mm-hmm.
I've stayed out for one day.
Why did you decide to go out for it?
I thought you ought to do something athletic. I mean, I played, have in mind that my high school class was 28, and I believe that was 15 girls and 13 boys, and I played football in high school, six-man football. Anybody could carry the ball, my mother owned the newspaper in this little town. It's a newspaper with a circulation of 400, so it was just something to do, really.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why I was on the starting team, but in any event, I was on the starting football team, and I thought that was just terrific. One ought to play sports, and so forth. Another thing that I wrote down. I think of myself as having, in that period, and probably until I was much older, supremely lacking in self-confidence. Pretty dominant in my experience there, my social experience there, and my social experience in law school.
Okay. So you talked about the union as a space on campus. What about...
Yeah, and the Kennedy Manor, is that still there?
The name sounds familiar, but I'm not sure.
It was a bar across the street from the Phi Gamma Delta House.
Okay.
And they would serve people underage. But you could also drink at 18 in those days. But the Kennedy Manor would be the place to go. I was involved with a fraternity in my second year, but I didn't like it much, so I didn't continue to pay attention to it.
Okay.
But I didn't activate.
Okay. David, I'm going to want to do a short follow-up with you. I have some things I need to wrap up here today. Some things came up, but I do want to, if there's anything on your mind right now that you might be afraid that when we may not be on your mind again when we meet for the follow-up interview, I want to give you, you know, space to have any final thoughts you might have for this session.
My first wife and I married after her graduation in my first year of law school and stayed married for many years, but not forever. And she died. I think I would have been involved in campus politics, but through Martha, the first wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then the decision to go to law school, which was that I would graduate from college at 19 and I would be unemployable.
Right.
Had no thought about getting a master's degree or about teaching. I decided I ought to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
Law school.
And I definitely want to ask you a bit about that when we do the follow-up interview.
Okay, fine.
So I do want to talk to you after I turn off the recorder. So I just want to do the closing here and say this concludes the first interview with David Stanley. David, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Okay, today is February 12th, 2016. This is a follow-up interview with David Stanley. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. David, to help us with sound quality, could you say your name and spell your last name?
David Stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y.
Great, thank you. So as I said before we turned the recorder on, I just had a few questions to finish up and then
Sure. Give
you space if there's some things you want to make sure we get on the oral history.
Sure.
So most of these questions come from the list I sent you previously, and the first one that I didn't get to was involvement in like college rituals, so, you know, specific dances or homecoming, things of that nature. So let's start there and go from there.
I don't think I was involved in much of that at all. Have in mind that I was 16 and there were an awful lot of World War II veterans still in college. It was a very, very big place at the time. It may be that big now, but it was 40,000 students, I think, in 1951. And lots of them having returned from service. So, no, I wasn't much involved, and I don't know how you would be. I mean, I'd probably have to be involved with either a dormitory where I didn't live or a fraternity, which I didn't really participate in.
Okay. What about athletic events? Did you attend athletic events?
Oh, yeah. We had Alan the Horse Amici was our fullback, and he became, of course, quite famous playing for the Baltimore Colts at that time. And you went to football games, and there was another star whose name I've forgotten, Jim something or other, back in the, you know, the very early 50s, late 40s. You'd go to football. Basketball, no. I don't remember being to any indoor events, but we did go to football. We didn't go to baseball.
Okay. So living off campus, were you ever involved or went to sort of informal off-campus parties?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, have in mind that in those days you could drink at 18, and but you couldn't vote until 21, of course. But you could drink at 18, and many of us could pass, or many of the places didn't care. So there was plenty of partying off campus, and much of it managed as if the people involved were older.
Okay. And so were these at people's apartments, houses?
Yeah, people's apartments, not particularly houses, although occasionally houses of townies. I mean, I remember a woman named Ramsberger whose father was a professor of some note, and I was at her house a number of times with other people. She wasn't a girlfriend of mine. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that kind of party would be political in the sense of particularly left-wing. I mean, there were a number of Ford students from the East who were quite left-wing. A couple of them were in the Young People's Socialist League, and we would sit around and talk about politics and drink cheap wine out of gallon bottles.
At that point, David, where were you politically in the spectrum?
I'm a genetic Democrat, Troy. My father once ran in a primary for Congress as a Democrat, and I've been a Democrat all my life, and relatively left-wing.
Okay. So you fit in politically at those parties.
I fit in, except I didn't quite go so far as people who were claiming the Rosenbergs were innocent and things like that. Hmm. I wasn't that far.
Okay. What role, if any, did religion or church play when you were here?
I have never been a member of any church, and I'm not religious and not a believer. My first wife, whom I met in my second year there, maybe I met her my first year, but we became involved in my second year, was Catholic, and I would sometimes go to church with her.
Okay. Just an aside, my wife is Catholic. I am not, nor am I religious. I had to go through the processes to be able to get married in the church when you got, so did I. Okay.
And let me tell you, whatever that was, 60 some years ago, 61 years ago now, I think, that Martha and I were married. And, they really expected you to join the church then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that happens anymore.
Yeah, I will, since this isn't about me, I'll tell you a quick story after we go off the record about getting married in the 90s in the Catholic Church. So, so my next question, and it's really sort of one of my last questions, is, and I think you addressed it a bit in the first interview, but let's ask it directly. Why leave UW when you did?
Well, I did say when we were talking before that I realized that I would graduate from the University of Wisconsin at 19 and be unemployable, so I'd have to go on to some kind of graduate school. I suppose I was fundamentally deficient in the sciences because of how I went to high school and what I did at the university. But I picked on law school because it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And actually only a in order to take the law school aptitude test, I had to
So, David, this leads me to a question you wanted to, or a topic you wanted to touch on in this follow-up session, and that's what you feel the effect was of coming here so young, and then also being so young in law school.
Well, and I think young in early life. I mean, I think that I was socially and emotionally unprepared for Wisconsin, and I wasn't a particularly wonderful student. Probably B's. I wasn't prepared for that. I wasn't prepared emotionally, psychologically, socially for law school, although after my first year I married, I come back to that in a moment. Almost everybody that I was in law school with, almost all the men were veterans, and I was, of course, 19 in 54-19. And when I got out of law school, all the people, I went to work at a very distinguished law firm, Paul Weiss Rifkind in New York, and all the people who were there were also 6-7 years older than I was, both finishing college, going to law school, being in military service. So I was, kind of like the kid all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that were there to be another program of acceleration, particularly for boys, maybe for girls, I would put into it an emotional and psychological support component that would get us ready. I mean, there's no reason in the world I should have gotten married at the age of 20. It required parental consent in Wisconsin at the time. No reason in the world I should have gotten married at the age of 20, and I did it, I think, because, you know, for the first time I had somebody who liked me, and I didn't have the self-confidence that I would have had I matured a little more, or a lot more.
Mm-hmm. David, there's something you mentioned in both the first interview and then the short follow-up, and that's being around adult males, a lot of them who were veterans, and I'm wondering if there was a tension or if you felt a tension between, you know, you being here at UW as a young man and having a lot of, you know, World War II veterans as, I guess, as your fellow students.
Maybe. That's not something that sticks in my mind. I will tell you that life then, in terms of the relevance or importance of military service, was very different than it is now. A few years ago, in a crowded bar in Livingston, Montana, on Veterans Day, I offered to buy a drink for every veteran in the bar, and there was one. To have been drafted, you probably have to be in your 60s, but there are plenty of people there in their 60s. And just one veteran in a crowded bar on Veterans Day. Not the way it was in 1950, 52, or in law school at 56, 57, 58, 50, 56 or 57. And pretty much everybody that was in my associate's class at Paul Weiss Rifkind was also a veteran. I went there at 22, and most other people were 27 or 28.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think one could prepare for that. I can tell you, as I've gone through life, being young was initially a disability, and then, from age 30 on, perhaps, an enhancement in career.
Mm-hmm. So, I think you said this about coming back after you graduated. I think we had that you came back to get married, but then you also came back because you had children that went here. Is that?
My son went to the University of Wisconsin. Of course, for the first 17 years after I left college, after I left Wisconsin, I was married to a woman whose parents. Well, for most of that, her parents lived in Baraboo, and then her brother lived in Baraboo. So we would go to Wisconsin, and if we were in Baraboo, you know, the fanciest place you can easily go is Madison. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, I know how to drive around Madison after 60-plus years. And when was I last there? I was there in connection with a funeral, like 6 months ago. That's the last time I was there.
Okay.
The funeral was in Baraboo and then down in Stoughton, but I stayed in Madison and was there for a couple of days.
Since you've been here off and on quite a bit, are there any changes that really strike you as you between, you know, going to school here in the 50s and then being here between then and now?
Well, I mean, the campus was more, I mean, there was stuff that went on in the West, but the campus was kind of like a yard, if you will. I mean, it was a relatively compact place. You know, it was a 5-minute walk from the foot of Bascom Hill to the physics building, which may not be there anymore, the one that the guys bombed about 50 years ago.
Yeah, it's still there.
All right. I mean, and physics was the end, pretty much the end, I think, of the letters and science or whatever it's called, campus. Now, of course, it's a massive place, you know, enormous, just enormous, and, you know, keeps on going. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, that may have to do with ancillary activities. What is the size of the student body now?
I think undergrad is in the, like, maybe high 20s, low 30s.
Okay.
But then there's also graduate students, professional students.
So now, 60 years later, it's about the same size as it was in 1951 with the people returning and the GI Bill.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I should know exactly, but I...
Let me say one other thing.
Sure.
about coming in young. I figured out maybe about when I was 37, 38 years old, I figured out that I was pretty good, so to speak, and from a business point of view and from a social point of view. I was okay, all right? Mm-hmm. And the only thing I knew before that was that I was smart. It doesn't make any sense to you? Lacking in self-confidence.
Right.
Until then. I knew I was smart. And actually, when I was in my late 20s and early 30s, I attracted a lot of clients when I was practicing law, as if there was some charisma, although I didn't have any understanding of that. I had no idea why clients kept coming to me. And I had quite a large practice, which was uncommon in a large law firm. You know, mostly the young lawyers didn't have any clients. They worked on the clients of the firm or the clients of the older partners. I became quite successful and was quite highly paid by the time I was 32, 33, but I just didn't get it. And I think that has to do with having been insecure, I think mostly related to my youth, for the formative years. College and law school and young associate law firm types.
Mm-hmm.
Times.
So, but you said by the 30s, that you in your 30s, things changed.
Well, I was very successful. I mean, I made a lot of money in my early 30s and until I was 35 in the practice of law. Way high, but if you inflated it to take care of the fact that it was 50 years ago, it was enormous, very, very good. And but I didn't have any feeling of self-confidence.
Okay.
I guess what I'm saying is the only thing in terms of psychological solidity that I had was kind of proof or an understanding that I was smart.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I was particularly good or competent or
Since I have a few more minutes, I wonder if you would, if you want to, or if you'd like to trace for me a bit more of your occupational life. So, you know, you're saying
I went to when I went to Columbia. It was look to the left, look to the right. One of the three of you won't be here at the end of the year. That's how they started. It was legitimate. I mean, it actually was said by Professor Goebel in a big auditorium. And I was, of course, scared to death. And at that point, they had one test for a semester course in the middle of the year, and all the rest of the tests for everything you'd done took place the following May or June. And I had no idea whether I would be one of the three that wasn't going to be there or whether I was doing well. I turned out to be eighth in the class. And there were some ties, so I was maybe fourth in the class, if you want to look at it the other way, of a class of starting out at 300. It was quite shocking. I mean, I learned about that when I was out in Baraboo working on the at that munitions plant. The one. I mean, Badger Ordnance Works, not there anymore, but maybe you don't know what I mean. But,
yep, I do.
Okay. And the mail got delayed and so on, and I finally learned in August that I'd been bid to the Columbia Law Review. And so, I went back, came back to get married later than that, but went back and went to the Law Review, and never had particularly good grades again, but I could work and didn't have to study because I could take exams. In any event, Paul Weiss was a very distinguished firm. I mean, I don't know if you know the big New York law firms at all, but it's as good as it gets these days, and was damn near that good in those days. I worked for some very distinguished partners, and one of them was Lloyd Garrison, whose grandfather was the liberator, William Lloyd Garrison, in black-white, in slavery stuff. But I was also competing against people who were older, more sophisticated, and some of them very, very, very good. One of them was perhaps the most distinguished lawyer of the last part of the 20th century, Arthur Lyman. And I looked at that competition and thought, I don't want to work this hard. You worked 80 hours a week. And I was married and ultimately had a child by that time. And so I wanted to get out of there. I went to Minneapolis in great measure because of the money I was offered. When I got out of law school, the going rate in New York for the best students was $5,500 a year. That would add up to about $250 or $275 an hour if you only worked a 40-hour week. It's about $160,000 now, I believe. In any event, I went to Minneapolis to a pretty fancy law firm, and my practice remained kind of a Wall Street practice. And I did that for the next 11 years. I became a partner when I was 29, which was the youngest that's ever happened and probably ever will, because nobody gets out of law school at 22 anymore, 21. And had quite a good practice and quite a number of clients, including some investment firms of some distinction. And one of those firms hired me in 1971. Still 35, to be executive vice president and the number two person there. Pretty good sized firm. And I did that in great measure because I had, by that time, 1971, I had six children. That has to do with marrying the Catholic years before. I had six children, and the fact that it's before birth control pills. And I knew that I would never get any wealth. All I would have was what I could save from having a good living practicing law. And I did that as the general manager of an investment banking firm where, the investment bankers and the brokers and what have you ultimately reported to me. And there was a chief executive who was the son of the founder. I did that for 11 years until the son of the founder's son was ready. And then I went again
Okay. Thank you for that overview. I appreciate that. So
probably, with the exception of the guy whose name I've forgotten, who was big in the development of MRI, probably was the most financially successful of those Wisconsin Ford students, I would guess. Mm-hmm. Certainly of those I know. Not terribly rich, but you know, pretty well off.
Mm-hmm. David, is there anything else you want to say about either your time here on campus as a Ford Scholar or anything else you feel would be good to get onto an oral history?
Well, I think it was a good experiment. Obviously, they did not continue it after the first 4 years. I've never quite understood why. I've read some of the studies of it. I think it had, as I said, pluses and minuses. It sure taught you that you were smart.
So, David, I need to chat with you briefly after we shut off the recording, but this concludes the follow-up interview and concludes the oral history with David Stanley. David, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.